My guest this week is Linda M. James. Linda is an author, a poet, a screenwriter, and for the last 20 or more years, she has been running creative writing classes. Linda is originally from Swansea. She's about to make her 48th house move. We learn about the inspiration for her novels. Many of them are set in the Second World War, often involving Spitfires. Linda explains why she was told at the age of 11 when at Catholic school that she was doubly damned. We talk about unhappy teachers, what education is about, how the discipline she had at school made her something of a rebel. She talks about how one should never tell someone they cannot do something. Linda once lived in Vienna where she wrote poetry, and we find out that she once, rather illegally, played Mozart's piano and why it would have been worth going to prison for. Linda reveals her writing processes, whether she knows in advance how a story will unfold, why she is particularly keen to play with notions of identity and why this relates to her own background, why she is fascinated by people's roots. We talk about the evolution of friendships, how the students she has taught are imprinted on her. We discover the importance of using different senses when writing. We learn that she is a fan of Pat Barker and Katsuo Ishiguro, and we discover that Linda keeps a diary, and why the happier she is, the less she writes, and how her writing saved her sanity. It was an enormous privilege for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews to meet Linda M. James. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it's an absolute pleasure this week to meet Linda M. James. And just before we started, Linda, you said that there's something very significant about the M.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm from Swansea, and I met a lady called Linda James in a film conference, and she's a film producer. And everybody was getting us muddled up, two Linda Jameses. So I said, I'm going to have to put Linda M. James in the middle. And she said, that's strange. I'm Linda M. James too. And I said, you're not. And then we started talking, and I said, where are you from? Yeah. She said, Swansea. I said, oh, good heavens. And she said, where do you go to school? And I said, Oakley House. And she said, so did I. But we were in different years and we never met each other.
Do you know, that's very similar to something that happened to me at university, because we've got the Welsh connection to look at in a minute. But I went to Lampeter and we had two students, completely different students, different year groups, but both going for the student union presidency in the same year, both called Andy White, both with the middle initial J.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah, and they both went for it, and one of them came first, one of them came second. So you became Linda M. James, but how did you distinguish, I suppose, I assume she's not a writer as well.
No, she's not. She's a film producer. So I went to the Cannes Film Festival many years ago, and everybody'd heard of Linda James. So when you all have badges, and they thought I was the film producer. Film producers have power and money. So I had all these people flocking to me, and I thought, gosh, why am I so popular? And then I said, I'm not a film producer, I'm a writer. And they all sort of drifted away. Writers don't have any money.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we've since the last couple of weeks had a new prime minister, and of course there's always somebody with the same name who suddenly up to this point may have had a Twitter account with a handful of followers, and suddenly people think, oh, this is the new prime minister. So this poor person who suddenly debuts with all these probably good and not necessarily good tweets, and it's like no, it's not me at all. Please don't associate me with all of that. But we've established that there's a Welsh connection. Now we're in Canterbury, where I've been based for many years. So do you want to say a little bit about how you've ended up here in Kent, and obviously then we can start to sort of go back and unpick along the way?
Well, I am nomadic because of my background, which I'll tell you about, but I'm actually in Canterbury because my husband, David, is an astronomer and science lecturer, and he was working, he got a job in Canterbury. We were living in Tunbridge Wells, which is where we met our mutual friend Susan, who came to my writing classes. So I moved here. And now we're moving again, and this will be my 48th move.
So, I'm not going to ask your age, but I'm guessing
that... Oh, I'm terribly old.
But on that sounds to me almost like a movie year, or pretty much so.
Well, I moved a lot when I was in university, and I moved from digs to digs and places, mainly because my father, terribly possessive Welsh father, he used to leave his card with everybody saying, if she's out late, will you give me a ring? And all these landladies were giving my father a ring, so I'd move digs, and he'd give somebody else one.
So it's been a long journey. But so the writing. So Susan Norville is our mutual friend, and so you've been running writing classes. I get the sense for quite a while.
20 years. Mm. I went and did a couple of MAs. It sounds as if I'm boasting. I'm not. I did MAs in Sussex University. First in English literature, and then I thought I'm going to do a creative writing MA. And then whilst I was there, I started writing my first two historical novels. It was centred on the Second World War, because I'm fascinated by the Second World War. And I know it's very odd for a woman. I'm fascinated by Spitfire planes. Mm. So I thought my main character is going to be a Spitfire pilot. So I went to the States to learn how to fly a plane, because I thought I want to be not a Spitfire, obviously, but so that I could have the experience of what it's like in a plane. And I went to Long Beach, California, and I had an amazing experience of flying right next to a jet. The school was right next to an airport. Can you believe that? So you had a little Cessna. And, of course, if you fly past near a jet, the plane just bounces and goes down. I was terrified. And the instructor said, oh, that always happens. And I thought, why didn't you tell me? My God, but it gave me the idea of how frightening it can be flying. And so Rob, my flyer, became my main character. And then I thought I had so much material from the Second World War that I had to write two books.
Yeah. And do you find that when you're writing, and this is a struggle that I've always had as somebody who keeps a diary, and I know that that's something that we'll come on to in a minute, but I find it very hard. People have said to me, oh, well, write a novel about your life, or use the material in the diary and, you know, create fictitious characters out of it. But that's where I think that maybe somebody else would be better placed to do that, because I'm providing all the information, and I'm very... possessive isn't necessarily the right word, but because there's the diary has to be a true record of what happened, I personally find it very difficult to know what to take out, how to fictionalise that story. But it sounds like you've sort of found a way through your own experiences of creating a novel that is both true to what happened, but also, in that sense, doesn't sort of name and shame.
Yeah, yes, I find it fascinating, because I have people in my writing classes that want to write memoirs. And there's a story, you know, Margaret Drabble and her sister, Antonia Byers, isn't it? One of them, I can't remember which one, wrote a memoir, and they haven't spoken since, because she said that was not our childhood.
Yeah.
But for one, I think it was Antonia Byers that wrote it. And she said, well, that's my perception of our childhood. And what's your perception? It might not be somebody else's. Somebody is a different age. They don't... I think... Also, the fact is that you're not the same parent. I've got three sons. The first one, you're learning. You know, the second one, by the third time, I didn't even notice my last son getting up and walking, because I was so busy. And I was so experienced as a mother then, and I was much more relaxed. And he's very relaxed.
Yeah.
But it is fascinating that our backgrounds, our experiences change for what position you are in the family as well.
Yeah, and I had that, because I remember with our very first daughter going to the health centre all the time, having her weighed, is she okay? You might be worried, is the breastfeeding going okay? You know, all those sort of questions. By the time you have other children, you always think, you know, there's no point even contacting the health visitor or even knowing where the health visitor is based anymore, because you've got that sort of experience. But what you're saying is right. I mean, I've got four children, two of them are twins, all completely different from each other, even the twins. I mean, they're only twins in name, let's put it that way. Mm. Their personalities are diametrically opposed.
It is fascinating. Yeah. I mean, I've got... My eldest son is very, very gregarious, outgoing. Mm. Jamie, my youngest, is quite reclusive. I mean, if you'd say we're having a large group, and he goes, oh, well, I won't be coming. Yeah. And Andrew says, oh, great, how many? Yeah. And I think, how are they? They're brothers. They get on really well, but they're completely diametrically opposed.
Yeah, it is interesting. And that's another thing as well. And I found it over the years with family members. So I was talking to a colleague here at work, actually, just literally a couple of weeks ago. And he said, do you know, Chris, he said, I think you're an extrovert. And that surprised me. And I think it surprised him as well. He said, maybe a shy extrovert. But it's like, and I suddenly realised, if I walk into a room, I'm much more comfortable going to the front and speaking than I am finding a space, you know, taking a seat and being in the audience for the next 2 hours or so and not having that sort of control. Mm. And it never occurred to me, because I was not like that when I was younger. I'd be petrified of being asked a question in class or standing at the front. But it's interesting how we change over time. And, you know, we are ourselves the same people. And we can see that trajectory, maybe. Mm. But sometimes you just think that, you know, my younger self could never have imagined that I'd have, you know, had that confidence to do such and such.
Well, I went to, you know, from Swansea, my father, he said he was controlling, but also I was really fond of him, and he was very proud of me. But it was hard, you know, he was proud of me, but I had to succeed. Mm. I had to achieve. But fortunately for me, I had a very good singing voice. So I won all the singing prizes in school. So that made him very, very happy. So I got him off my neck a little bit, but that gave me the confidence, knowing that if I said to all the students I've taught, just find one thing you're good at, and it gives you confidence to do lots of other things.
Yeah.
And it's just finding that one thing. Mm. And I think that saved me, because they sent me to a convent as a Protestant. And not only that, I'm a left-handed Protestant. And for the Catholics, the nuns, absolutely horrified. One of them told me, it sounds awful, you're doubly damned. And I was 11, and I thought, I'm doubly damned. Because she said, you're left-handed, sinistre, sign of the devil, and you're not a Catholic. And I thought, oh, that's terrible, really terrible. And I was, for about 6 months, I went really into my shell. I was really devastated. And then the Reverend Mother, I was singing Ave Maria at the end of school. That she loved Ave Maria, so I had to sing it. And my friends are going, oh, you're not going to sing Ave Maria again, are you?
Do you know, well, I suppose it's easy to say now, but not, but this wouldn't have occurred to you at 11, because isn't it the old adage about, you know, two negatives equal make a positive?
Because I sang so beautifully, the Reverend Mother came up to me and said, God has given you a gift. Mm-hmm. And I thought, so I'm blessed, I'm fine. And I thought, why did that nun, but there's a lot of nuns that go into a convent that are not very happy women, I found out. And they projected that unhappiness onto the children, and they criticised you a lot, which is a terrible, terrible way to teach.
And I completely agree. And I also think that a lot of this comes to light, doesn't it, in more recent years, when you have people, Nicky Campbell, the broadcaster, talking about his experience at school and abuse that went on in Scotland, I think, in the 1970s. And it's a really strange dynamic, because these days, of course, if anybody does anything completely inappropriate, well, it's all going to be over social media. I mean, I've people I went to school with, you know, I've seen them post things on social media about, you know, a teacher at our school died, and he was a very loved teacher, and it was like, oh, but this person embarrassed me, and you know, I lost all confidence at the age of 11. And other people were like, oh, we were sorry to hear that, but, you know, that wasn't our experience, but this person has now died. So it's like, well, you know, of all the times to say this when that person can't defend themselves. But it's tragic when that kind of behaviour, which was meted out, and I remember, you know, the days of the cane, you know, again, you would never get away with that now. But what that then does, and not just at the age of 11, but the way that impacts on you for decades later, traumatises you as you think back on those school days and those memories that are, in some cases, at best, bittersweet.
Yes, but the strange thing is, for me, the school was harsh, and there was no heating in the winter, because they thought, what a waste. And the nuns were wearing very, very thick clothes. But, of course, in the summer they boiled, but in the winter they were okay. Whereas we were sat, I used to have chilblains that used to bleed regularly all over my schoolwork, and I had to keep repeating it, because they said, you've got blood in your work. And I thought, well, that's because I got chilblains, because it's so cold. Yeah. And it was, it sounds Dickensian. But I had close friendship there, because I had really good friends that I'm still in contact with now because of that shared background. And for me, and every year we had the Eisteddfod, and I loved that. And because I had the confidence from singing, they made me a house captain of one of the teams. And I was very good at whipping up people's enthusiasm. So for 2 years, when I was the captain, we won everything, because they said, you know, you can write stories, you can write poems. So I said, can I have 4 poems next week? And I'd have about 10. And I'd say, great. So we flooded the, and I realised that I'm actually very good at galvanising people and inspiring them. Yeah. And that sounds arrogant, but I've been doing creative writing for 20 years, and I've had a lot of my students are now published because I gave them the confidence to say, yes, you can do that, and here's how you do it.
Yeah, and it sounds as though, so those sort of experiences obviously were, I mean, at the time terrible, and still terrible in the sense that there's no excuse for them, but it's what you did, how you responded to them that is interesting. But I'm just thinking as well, you're in touch with some of those people. Do you talk about those sort of experiences? I mean, obviously, this is the thing that you all have in common. But you must be looking back, and if all your friends from those days have got children or grandchildren, etc. now, you must sort of, that sort of comparison and that sort of sense of, you know, how did they get away with it? Or maybe we wouldn't be the people we are today if we hadn't had that torture.
This is the strange thing, is when I was talking about the people's backgrounds being completely different. One of my oldest friends is Cecily, went to school, and she's much more passive than me. She liked the convent. She was quite happy. See, the convent, they didn't want you to think. They said, right, write notes. This is what we're telling you. And that's all we did. We wrote notes. And I had a brain that wanted to say, I wanted to question. So I'd say, excuse me, mother, what if it this? And they were horrified. I was asking questions. Or especially accepted things.
And it makes you think exactly what education was then. Because when I was at school, and it was a very good school in Cardiff, and, you know, I think 95% of people went on to university or whatever. But this is really interesting, because if you'd asked me as a teenager, what is school for? I wouldn't have said, oh, it's human flourishing or education and learning. I'd say, you know, discipline, almost as though it's being made to be a good citizen. The things I remember, the things that struck fear in me, was the teacher shouting at you because you were walking on the wrong side of the stairs. And looking back, and you just think it's nonsense.
Yes.
But at the time, you know, that was the thing. Or if they blew a whistle and you were still playing football, I never played football. But if you didn't stop or you didn't hear the thing, then you'd have to stand in the corner or whatever. And you look back on those things now and you just think, that's frightening. But that was kind of our day-to-day.
Yes. I mean, that was exactly the same in our school. We had to walk up a staircase on the left, and you were not allowed. And if you veered into the middle, one of the nuns would stare at you, and you'd think, oh my God, I'm going to be expelled. Yeah. I mean, I was running down the corridor once, and one of the nuns said to me, come and see me in my study after lessons. And all day I was shaking with fear because I thought, she's going to expel me. And I was just running in the corridor because I was by myself, and I thought, nobody can see me. Yeah. And, you know, I was 11 and I was happy.
Yeah.
But it is very strange. But I don't know, in a strange way, that discipline, that made me a bit of a rebel. I mean, it either goes like Cecily, who accepted everything, or me, thinking I left school questioning everything. Why do I have to take notes and accept every... why couldn't I ask questions? Why couldn't I think for myself? And then when I did my MAs, and I thought, wow, they actually want me to say what I feel. Yeah. And what I'd learned, and then have an influence into what I was writing rather than just received. Wordsworth, this is what he thought, write this down. And I thought, well, perhaps he didn't think that.
Yeah. And it's extraordinary, isn't it, that it's almost as though, I mean, obviously, I'm not a science person, but one of the things about science, you know, it's either right or wrong. I mean, there's far more to it than that, of course. But with literature, almost the joy of, you know, when you've got 12 or 13-year-olds reading Shakespeare and the teacher would say, no, that's not the right interpretation, or, you know, you don't know what the word means, you're thick, that sort of thing. Well, of course, you're not going to ever enjoy Shakespeare in that sense, because you associate it, you know, you think, oh, it's too difficult, it's too challenging, or, you know, I'm too stupid to understand the complexity of the great writings. And I wonder, you know, to what extent, I mean, you know, you couldn't have teachers like that today. I mean, a lot of my students go on to be teachers, and I think, you know, there's no way that they could ever be like those teachers from yesteryear. That's one comfort I have. So my children will be all right. but I do wonder sometimes, you know, the nature of education, how it's changed, how it's perceived. And as fodder, if that's the right word, for your writing, I'm guessing that drawing on all that experience, and the pain, the anguish that must come with that, and maybe in some cases you've accepted it, But also, I'm guessing that whether you're conscious of it or not, this must be something that works its way through your creative writing.
Well, it must do. The fact is, I had to be stoic. I had to accept. I had to endure, really. And I got through my school years because of the friendship I had. But I couldn't say they were really enjoyable educationally-wise because I'm thinking all my education came later when I did an open university degree, which I think I could recommend anybody to do. The coursework materials, they actually said, this is how you write an essay. I was in school for so many years. Did anybody show you exactly how to write an essay, how to formulate an argument? No. And that was the best thing I've ever done.
Yeah.
The Open University was an amazing people that were marking all the work. Yeah. How many hours they did it, I don't know. I mean, the notes they gave you, look at the reference there. And you could really, and it really made me think, and it opened up a whole universe of knowledge to me that I'm so happy I did it. And I thought, why isn't it they gave you ideas, but they wanted you to use your own. Here's these ideas, shape your argument on those ideas, and this is how you can do it. And I got A's all the way through it because of that, because I just flourished. I mean, I thought this is what it should have been like at school.
And did you know, did you ever keep in touch with, or do you ever hear about what happened to those teachers from when you were young? Because what would they think? I mean, I'm sure many of them, you know, would have passed on, but what would they have made of the, you know, obviously you were obviously more educated and more intelligent than them by the sound of it. But I mean, the way that you flourished, you know, I'm trying to work out, you know, in spite of or because of or both, those experiences. I'd love, you know, do you ever have that need to sort of go back and say to those teachers, you know, look what I've achieved?
Well, I did with the English teacher because I've still got it. And I used it as an example with my students. I was, well, you are, at 15, I was very romantic. As a 15-year-old girl, and I wrote an essay about wandering in the woods. And it was flowery, over the top. And she slated it, and she said, this is absolute drivel, Linda, absolute drivel. You will never pass anything with it. And I've kept that, and she gave me an F minus. I thought, how could you do that to a 15-year-old girl? And I kept it, and when I was teaching, and I said to people, I said, I've got 3 degrees, I'm not boasting, but I said, this is what my teacher did, and from that, F minus, I moved on to there, and I said, that's what you can do if I give you some of the tools and you've got the confidence, you can soar. And I said, don't be restrained by people telling you you can't do things. And I'm so passionate that, you know, you should never tell somebody you can't do it. You might find it hard, but I mean, within reason, I can't be an eye surgeon, but I can do an awful lot of things that... You know, so many people put people down, and I'm so angry about it because you can see the damage it does. I mean, all my writing classes, I've had people coming saying, oh, you know, I'm not really bright now. I haven't got many qualities. I can't do this. And I said, OK, here's a little pot. And I said, every time you say anything negative, you've got to put, it was only a joke, 50p in the middle. And they all stopped doing it. And I said, no negativity. Right, what can you do? Okay, and it really did work.
Yeah, and it's so interesting, isn't it? Because these days, if somebody gets, well, if they get an F minus, then there has to be some form of moderation, or there has, you know, there's a template, there's a syllabus.
I mean, you can't get an F minus,
no,
can you?
But it sounds like, you know, somebody said to me once when I was at university, they're from another country, I think they were maybe in Denmark, and they said, oh, I had this teacher at school, I really appreciated him, he was tough, but if he was in a good mood, you know, he might give you a good mark. If he was not in a good mood, he'd give you a bad mark. But, you know, you knew where he was coming from and he made you work hard. And I thought, oh my God, that's the worst sort of teacher. You're telling me that because the teacher's in a bad mood, he slates you. I mean, if I'm in a, you know, often there are days when I wake up and think, well, I'm not in a good place, but I'm not going to suddenly
take it out on
take it on my students. In fact, if anything, I would go the other way. Almost that's my recalibration.
Yes.
Because otherwise, if you're in a dark place to begin with, you're just going to be in an even darker place.
Yes.
If you then take it on the students, knowing that there will be repercussions long term as well, if you give F minuses left, right, and centre. So the writer, obviously, you've taught creative writing, but in terms of your own writing, I know poetry is also something very dear to you.
Yes,
how much of this have you done? How much have you published over the years?
I've been writing poetry. In fact, I lived in Vienna. I mean, I've said I'm nomadic. I've lived in Malta for 6 years, Vienna for a year, which I absolutely adored. And all the time I was in Vienna, that's all I wrote is poetry. And I was inspired by all the surroundings and the music, because I'm musical, and the history. And Mozart lived down... Oh, I must tell you this story. Mozart lived four doors away from me, and I used to walk past his house often. And I went in there one day with David. He wasn't my husband then. We were partners. And you can't do it now, but you could walk in to the house via the original doorway. And upstairs was Mozart's piano with a great big grill over it. And I thought, and there was only me and David in the room, and I thought, can I do this? And I took the grill off the piano, and David was absolutely horrified. He said, you can't do that. He said, it's illegal. And he ran out of the house. And I thought, I'm going to do it. And I knew I'd be in trouble. And I thought, I'm going to play Mozart's piano. So I sat down and I played the piano before there was a thunder of feet, and two guards came up. And I thought, they're going to throw me in prison. They were really, really angry and were screaming at me in German. And I thought, I'm just going to pretend I'm very stupid. And I said, I'm sorry, I can't understand what you're saying. I'm sorry. And I just kept saying it. And they got so angry and so annoyed, they just said, get out, you stupid woman. And I just ran down the street and started dancing. I thought, I played Mozart's piano.
Yeah.
When I went back to Vienna a number of years ago, they've now got a sheet of glass right in front of the piano.
So anybody listening to this who made that trip especially will say, why? And now they know.
Yeah, and I thought I had to do it. And David said, oh, you're going to give me a heart attack.
Yeah.
And I said, one off. I said, it would have been worth going to prison for, just to say I've sat and played on the same piano as Mozart. And it was the highlight of my year there.
Yeah.
And I haven't written about it yet, but I'm going to do it because they've reconfigured the whole place. It's now it's a tourist thing. And then this is how Mozart lived, and they've changed it a lot.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Vienna is a wonderful place, but it's also a very dark place. I did an awful lot of research. I'm always doing research. I love finding out things. And I read about a woman. This is a bit dark. And she was watching a documentary on the television one night about heads that had been put in this room. And it was all from the handicapped children. And they had stored all these heads in this room. And she said, I knew my sister was among them. And her sister was epileptic. And that was considered to be degenerate. And she was put in this special centre. And they had a special room in Vienna full of these skeletons and heads for children. You're thinking, that is so dark, so incredibly dark.
Yeah.
And this, the beauty and the history of Vienna, you see as a tourist, is the facade. And it is beautiful and musical, but there's such a dark, dark side to it. I mean, my latest book is centred in Vienna, which I'm hoping is going to get published. It was supposed to be published this year, but the publisher got long COVID, so it's going to be, I don't know, next year. But the Gestapo headquarters were in Vienna. You can't see what it is now. And I thought, I'm going to centre my book in the run-up to the Second World War in Vienna, and then I'm going to move it. It's called The Vienna Connection. So you've got two voices. One is Elise, a concert pianist, because it's full of music. I mean, I'm musical. So I thought, I'm going to make her a concert pianist. And she has a son, and the son is abducted, and she doesn't know where he is. And so that's a sequel as well. I've written a sequel. So Vienna is this beautiful, it's a place full of facades, beautiful and dark.
Yeah. And when you're writing then, I mean, obviously you're drawing on all these experiences, but do you sort of know what the novel is going to be before you write it? Or is it a case of, you have to have some sort of germ of an idea, but is it the case that while you're writing it, it all starts to fall into place? Or is it like a jigsaw where maybe at least in your head, if not actually on paper, everything is mapped out and your job is to actually get from, you know, beginning to end?
It's different for me, it's different for almost every novel. With my psychological thriller, The Day of the Swans, it came as an image, you know, in part of Wales. I don't know if you've been to the Gower Coast.
Yeah.
On the Gower Coast, I don't know if I hate mentioning it, it's my favourite place, but everybody goes there. And I have to say, Rosilli Bay is the most exquisite bay I have ever seen. You know, miles and miles of a curve of yellow sand with a cliff. And on the cliff is a white house, and it used to be a vicarage. And as a girl, I used to, you have to hike down lots and lots of cliffs to get there. So it's almost deserted every time I've been there, which is wonderful. I mean, the top of it is full of tourists, but it's only the people that really want to go down that have to climb down a long way. And I was in bed one night, and the image of the cliff and the White House came into me, and I thought, somebody's going to take somebody there against her will. And that was the beginning of The Day of the Swans. And the man who takes her is Stefan. And he, again, is German. All my influences in life. And he goes to see a trainee psychologist called Anna and tells her that all her life has been based on lies. And within a few months, she starts to believe him.
Yeah.
And all her identity is taken away. So I've realised that in all my writing, I play with identity, and I never knew that until I was doing the last novel, and I thought, I'm playing with identity again. And it was really strange that I hadn't noticed that connection. I'll tell you why. Because when I was two, I was adopted. And so that's why I'm fascinated where people come from. And I was born, and I've been doing research. My middle son, Simon, is fascinated with the past, as I am, and we've been trying to find out my true background. I know my birth mother's name. I know my father was a Canadian, but I was adopted into a Welsh family, and I always felt theirs. I didn't feel adopted, because they didn't tell it. Half the family never knew I was adopted. I was theirs. I was their only child, and I was very precious to them. So I felt very loved. But this search has always made me question the past and people's roots and where you come from and how you develop. And I'm sure that search for identity has made me a nomad, because I'm always wanting to move. And I like change, but there's also part of me, I've got a cousin she's never moved from Swansea, she stayed in the same job.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, she's got her roots firmly in Swansea. And my roots are a bit there, a bit there, a bit there, a bit there.
Yeah.
But I can't change the way I am.
Yeah, and it's what you then do with it. Because I suppose my fear, I think, when I was younger of leaving places was, I suppose, it's the sense that you've built up this entire, you know, body of, well, friendship, perhaps to an extent, although the friends often go, you're the only one left. But also you think, well, I've achieved all these things. Well, if I stay in the same place, you know, I'll continue on that path. But often it doesn't work that way. And it's whenever I have moved, I've never regretted it. But it takes me a while to sort of pick up the confidence to actually make that next step, both geographically and also in terms of employment, etc. But isn't it really intriguing how, in the case of your own writing, you know, you're drawing on this, you're the common link, really, that you talk about identity, but you might have moved 48 times, etc., but you're taking a very clear and definable sense of who Linda is to all of those places. And I'm guessing that in all the places you've been, you've done, certainly in recent years, you've set up these writing classes. So I can imagine that there are writing classes all around the country, and by the sound of it, maybe even overseas, where they've got your imprint all over them, rather than have them all in one place for decades.
Yes, that's a nice idea, because I am starting writing classes in Eastbourne, and I'm really looking forward to it, because I know I'm going to meet new friends. I'm sad to lose... I've got a young man that's been coming to my writing classes for 8 years, max. Lovely young man. And he's finished his first book, and I know I've helped him with confidence, and I'm going to help him get it published, and I'll miss him. But I know that, you know, they're part of me, and I take my friendships. I've got friends all over the place, but they come with me in my heart. Yeah. And the ones that are all true friends, I'll never be parted from. Cecily and I have been writing. She's a dinosaur. She will not go on social media. She won't have emails. And I said, Cess, well, how will I? And she said, you'll have to write me letters. And I've been writing her letters for 40 years.
And I think that's the difference. For me, I was not in the greatest of places, probably about 5-6 years ago, well, more than that. And I would always think, who are those people who made an impact on my life, people at university? Where are they now? What are they doing? You know, are they? If I saw them again, would I suddenly pick up from where I left off? Yes. The answer is yes to that. Or of course, you know, would I regret all of that? And I was missing all these people. And then a combination of lockdown and social media has, of course, ensured that, as you will find, you might move to Eastbourne, but of course, you're still going to keep in touch with people. Mm. It's not necessarily the same, but you'll develop new friendships, but also you'll retain all the old ones. I mean, the people I went to university with, I think there are literally one or two who are still in Lampeter, but everyone else, of course, is in Wales or England or overseas. And we sometimes meet up in Lampeter. Often we don't, but we have virtual book reading sessions and all sorts of things that take place. Yeah. Oh. Well, Susan was involved in those, on Monday, the first Monday, I think, of the month. So the Lampeter, so anybody who's been at Lampeter, who's published, say, a novel or whether it's an academic thing or poetry, they will perhaps read an excerpt and talk about their motivation. So that sounds very similar, actually, to what you do.
I think you keep in touch more. I mean, I don't keep in touch. Cecily and I, every time I go down to Wales, I obviously go and see her first. As she's one of my oldest friends, but there's some friends I don't see for a long, long time. But when I do, if they're close friends, we just fall back into the same slot. Other friends, I mean, I suppose you lose touch with, and I think that's part of life as well. There's some, you can't keep in touch, you can't have that firm friendship with everybody you meet in your life. Yeah. I don't think, and some of the students. Perhaps I will never see again, but that's okay, because they're still imprinted on me, and I've got some lovely memories of them. And I've, you know, you were talking about the poetry I wrote, you know, the one we did with Susan, United for Ukraine. Well, one of my students is hosting a Ukrainian family, and last week I bought the poetry book for her, and she was so delighted, and I signed it to her and her two children. And it just puts it into perspective, doesn't it? You know, you think about the problems you have, and then you meet a woman who's come over with two small children and her husband's fighting in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And she said to me, I don't know if I'll ever see him again. And you think, my gosh. You know, the fact that I'm having stress moving again, and it's so irrelevant and insignificant.
Yeah. Well, but that's the thing, isn't it? Because some people can be very, you know, I know people, maybe even in my own family, who you know, if the freezer suddenly defrosted or something, you know, they couldn't cope. Yeah. But suddenly there's some like big family breakup or death, and suddenly they have this hope or this ability to somehow, this sturdiness and steadfastness, and you think, hang on a minute, so you can handle the fact that somebody's life has just fallen apart, but you're worried that the freezer, you know, all that maybe all the leaking all over the floor. I mean, really in perspective. But I was just thinking, because in my office, thinking the ring binders over there, my grandfather, he wrote, there's probably a good few million words in total. He was 95 when he died, but in the last decade, after his wife of, you know, our grandmother of 61, I think, years, after she died, they both met in the Second World War, he wrote his memoirs. And I think that's what kept him going for so long, because he'd go to the pub at lunchtime because he couldn't do any writing after that. But in the morning, on an electronic typewriter, because computers were not his thing, he would write everything up. But what you've said is exactly what happened to him, because we know that obviously they both survived the war. If they hadn't survived the war, I wouldn't be here now. Yes. But at the time, of course, they never knew day to day if they'd ever see each other again. So the whole "we'll meet again," which has been very much in the news with the death of the Queen. But how fascinating that, you know, he's writing this up, but almost, you know, he's reimagining from 70, as it was at the time, 70 or so years previously. And he was putting himself back in that mindset of what was happening. But also, of course, the way in which it's written very much is a sort of, you know, this is a love that will never die. And of course, it never died. So in that sense, you know, he's aware of what happened. But at the time, you know, day to day, he couldn't have anticipated what would happen. And you think what that must have done to that generation when, and they were letter writers in those days, obviously, rather, they couldn't keep their letters because of the war, and all for security reasons, they couldn't take them around with them. What an impact that had. And just reading this, it's just breathtaking. It literally belongs to a different age.
Yes, it's strange you're saying that, because, you know, that the poem I wrote for one of them was called The Photograph. And I didn't know. I was, at the time, I just saw a photograph from the First World War, a young couple, and he was wearing a uniform. And I thought that they're separating, and that's why I wrote that. And I thought that applies to the Ukrainian war. You know, they're one picture could be the last time that they're together, or it could be they're together for 40 more years, as I finished the poem. But this is it. I mean, their lives in the Second World War, which is why I find it so fascinating, because it brings out the best and the worst in people. You know, think of the black market in the Second World War. And there are other people doing masses and masses of good work and having no money for it, very little money. So I suppose it heightens the drama of writing, which is why I find it quite a fascinating, because you bring out, as I say, the best and the worst in people.
And do you find as well that, because obviously you're a writer, do you voraciously read other people's work, or do you find that sometimes, as I do, sometimes I'll read. I always have a novel, or often these days, often have a diary, somebody's diary actually, on the go. But sometimes something's got to give, and you've got to sometimes weigh this up. You know, how do you balance the, reading somebody else's work, but also, you know, needing to get your own project done? So do you find that the balance? And also, of course, you're teaching students, so in that sense, you're obviously reading their work as well.
I think as a writer, you ought to be a reader. Well, also, as I say to people, if you're not reading things, I mean, you're, the writer's not going to have any job. But I do love, I mean, I've got so many favourite authors, but Pat Barker, I think, is amazingly powerful, visceral writer of... and I use this as an example with my students, you know, about using all the senses when you're writing, and people don't. Yeah. They say, and she's wonderful at using a sense to move you back in time, and she's got it in Resurrection, I think, the book about the First World War. And Rivers, the psychiatrist, is walking down the corridor, and he hears the blinds at the end of the corridor going click, 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 and all of a sudden, in the next paragraph, double spaced, he's on a ship, and the ship's mast is going click, 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 and so. She's got that transition as she moves you back in time, 40 years, just by one sound. Yeah. And I say to the students, this is how you can move back and forward in time, using a technique like that. And she's so good at it. And you at first, you won't notice it, but I'm teaching them techniques like that. Look at novels and see the techniques that good writers use to move you around in time without you being aware of it. And they're guiding you back into the past. And she's an amazing writer. And, of course, I can never pronounce his name. Ishiguro. Is it Kazuo Ishiguro?
Yes.
I was telling my students, and one of them always correcting me. Yeah. And he's a beautiful writer, absolutely stunning. And I met him once in London, and he's so modest.
because he was a student here at Kent in the 70s. And I was actually, it's funny, I was just talking about him yesterday with a colleague here, because he wrote Remains of the Day, and yes. We were talking about the film adaptation of that. He was an English student, I think maybe a contemporary of Gavin Eslers, who's also involved with this university, in the 70s.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. Yes, because I taught the Remains of the Day to some students, yeah. And they were going, oh, there's nothing happening, is there? Yeah. Nothing happening in this book at all. And I said, have you not noticed? And he's so understated. Mm. I said, you've got to look at it. What he's doing with this repressed butler, and how he's repressing all his emotions. And he leaves. He doesn't realise that he's met the love of his life. And it is so incredibly sad and moving. And he, you know, I'm always saying, try and show, not tell. But he does tell. He just says, there's one line. He says, at that moment, when his love walks away to her husband, yeah. My heart was breaking. Mm. And I said, have a look, read it again. They read it again. Mm. But they were so used to books with lots of action that this understated, they couldn't do it. And I think his books are absolutely superb.
Yeah. And I have really been affected. I have read the novel, but I read it many years after seeing the film, and I've seen the film far more times than I've read the novel. But you know, you are right, and I think what is so powerful in there is it's the opposite of something that's inert. But the point is that because of the repression, what really affects you, and certainly I've had similar experiences, and that sort of sense that maybe you want to make up for lost time, maybe there's somebody you know is very important to you, and you have a second chance, but then that chance is gone, and you discover that actually, you know, maybe you had that moment. And that's what literature can do. That's why people write poetry. And obviously, people may write for money, etc. But really, you have to have that talent. You have to have that urge to do so. And I found it captivating. And the number of times, you know, I've often walked out of a film and somebody might say, so what's the film about? And you're thinking, you know, I'm not going to reduce it to a plot because it's, you know, I feel the film rather than, you know, simply say, you know, X meets Y and then Z intervenes. But you keep a diary as well.
I do. Yeah. I haven't written one. It's strange. The happier I am, the less I write a diary. The darkest times when I went through a really, really bad divorce, my diary is a way of keeping me sane because I kept thinking, I've got no money, I've got no house, I've got children, what am I going to do? I can't cope. And I was in a spiral of thinking, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And one of my friends said, what are you going to do tomorrow? And I said, what do you mean? She said, just think about what you're going to do tomorrow. And then get through tomorrow and think what. So I started writing the diary because of that. Yeah. Today I'm going to do this. Yeah. And I look back in the diary and it is so self-pitying. Mm. You know, oh, me. I've got these problems. I can't do it. And as I started getting stronger, I started looking out. And all of a sudden, I'm looking at the world and looking at everything else. And I'm thinking, my gosh, my writing saved my sanity.
Yeah. Oh, for me, the diary has been therapy, salvation, because it was a voice that I didn't have in other context. And suddenly what I realised is that when you've, you know, going through a divorce as well, when there's that lack of control, or you feel you speak out, there was a period when I was sort of fine at work, but when I was in a home space, I was stuttering and stammering. I couldn't get a word. I couldn't get my words out, and that was frustrating me because I thought, you know, being able to speak, to communicate, is obviously my job, but also it's my passion. If that is taken away from me, what's left? So the diary compensated, you know, filled that void, and so I was writing more and more. So suddenly, you know, whereas in the olden days, you know, go back decades, I'd be writing everything down in an old W.H. Smith diary, you know, the ones you get from the shop, and you'd have a limited number of space. In later years, everything is written down on the computer, and I actually went back over all my old diaries and annotated them while my memory was still in place, just sort of, you know, 1993. I'd have all these great memories of 93, but they weren't always in the diary. So as I was going through the diary, I'd think, oh, and, you know, and that happened later on that day. And of course, sometimes you know that the memories are often composite. And of course, you may be misremembering. But because I was italicizing those memories, it wasn't as though I was in reinserting them into the voice of my 19-year-old self. It was clearly me many years later. But doing that just in order to flesh out something that I just wish at the time, you know, I'd had the chance to do. But the diary was a corrective, I think, against madness. Mm. It also meant that the fact that I could write about what was happening, and in a way nobody was answering me back, it meant that I had some control. I had some agency over my life. Mm. And I'd be doing that every night, midnight, one in the morning and later. And I was not getting very much sleep. But if I hadn't had the diary, I don't think I would have had the ability to cope.
Yes, it's fascinating, isn't it, the writing? And people are drawn to writing because of overcoming problems. Yeah. I mean, everybody I have, I have a wonderful man in my classes who's absolutely amazing, and he's been sectioned. And the only way he got over that, and he said, I've got to write a memoir about my experiences. Because he said I was sectioned against my will, and I didn't have what they had. And so he's got all this anger inside him because he was put in a place against his will. And he's very intelligent, and he's very lucid about what happened to him. And writing is saving him. I try and get inside the core of my characters to make out what... And I actually start out all my classes with a characterisation worksheet, which is based on a psychological model of what makes somebody tick. What are they? And I've got about 20 questions that students have to ask about their, you know, what are characters like about themselves? What do they hate? Mm. What would they change about themselves? What's their happiest moment? What's their worst moment? And I said, I won't go through all the questions because they're long, but I said, once you've answered all those, you'll know how your character thinks, walks and speaks, and then they'll become really human. Yeah. They'll be real beings with flaws, and we all have flaws.
Yeah.
And then you have to work out, how do you disguise them?
And it's when people come into your... I mean, this is the thing about the diary, because apart from the annotating that I'm talking about, you're writing it on the day or the next morning. So it's a contemporary record. Mm. So if somebody's in your life and somebody, you think, oh, this is a good person, we've got all these things in common, and you have the diaries full of, oh, I had this meeting, and, oh, I'm looking forward to seeing them next week, and, you know, so you've got that record. But if suddenly, you mentioned Jekyll and Hyde, if a few weeks or months later, that person, this has been my experience, somebody comes into your life, and then actually you think, actually, that they're not perhaps the person that I thought they were. Mm. Inadvertently, the diary has got a record of that, because, you know, you're not then thinking, oh, I know, you know, that this person was a rogue, and therefore you rewrite based on what you know, and you say, oh, you know, from the very beginning, this person didn't, you know, wasn't the person that I thought they were. The diary almost is as being as a contemporary record, you never know how it's going to unfold. So I keep a record every day, but I don't know what's going to be in the next day's diary. But I don't know until I actually write it, because I'm harnessing all those different things that happened. And it's sort of chronological. I sort of start with what happened in the morning, and then, you know, I work through the day. So it's very much a record. And I'll include, if necessary, letters, emails, you know, in there as and when necessary. But then I realised that effectively I've got the seeds here of of a novel in this, because effectively, and it's a first-hand account of somebody who comes into your life, and I think these are the films I watch all the time. And I do think the person I'm thinking of was very aware of that. She knew exactly what my interests were, and she'd read some of my own work. So presented herself almost as a sort of, I can't say character because I don't write fiction, but almost as a sort of, you know, knew the sort of interest that I have, and really played on that, and knew that I kept a diary. So I almost wondered sometimes if somebody was almost manipulating, you know, it was a manipulation, because they'd say, they might randomly mention something in a conversation, and of course it would end up in my diary that day.
Oh.
So so I'm sitting on something, and the question, and of course these are people who are in this very place where we're sitting, in this very building, this very campus. But, you know, I have to be very careful not to name everybody. But at the same time, I kind of feel that I know that I can or maybe ought to do something with it. But I almost, you know, think, you know, the consequences of doing that are so vast. I should wait.
Perhaps you can do it when you're older.
Yeah.
And for me, I think the diary, although I haven't written it, the busier I am in life, and especially with moving, I haven't written it for a long time. But I can't, it's strange you're saying you type. Yeah. There's two things I can't type. I type all my novels.
Yeah.
I have to handwrite poetry, and I have to handwrite my diary. And I'm so unused to writing by hand now. My hand really aches after I've been doing it. And I thought, gosh, how did I manage in school writing notes hour after hour?
No, I think it's similar because I go to the cinema a lot, and it's the same with posture. That sometimes I'd be sitting, if I'm a bit too close to the screen, I'm looking up, and I couldn't work out at first why I was always having this terrible ache in my shoulder or my back. Yes. And then of course I realised it was like, well, if you, the same night for 2 hours you're sitting in an uncomfortable position, then obviously it's going to impact on you. So in the same way, and I've had it as well with lots of furious note taking when I was doing my PhD, for example, then I was having shooting pains down my arm, and I thought, am I going to die? You know, and of course it was obviously just a muscular thing because of my posture.
Yes, well, that's what I mean. I used to do a lot of, well, I still do yoga, but where I get tension, of course, is my shoulders, because I walk a lot, but when I'm typing, I'm so concentrated on what I'm writing, I'm not aware of my body, and my body is all hunched up and my shoulders are squashed. So, and she said, what do you have to, and she's given me these exercises for my shoulders.
Yeah.
And I thought, isn't it amazing that you can lose yourself in something and you're not aware of your body?
Yeah.
I find that quite fascinating. And the moment I stop, all of a sudden, I'm thinking, oh God, I can't move this. Yeah. But for 2 hours or however long I'm writing, I'm not in the room, I'm in this story.
Yeah. And having, you know, being the architect in that sense of what you're doing, you know, then, you know, because you're not responsible for what other people do, and we can't be. You know, sometimes people don't do the things the way we would like them to, and it's very frustrating. But when it comes to your writing of that and the way that you're able to articulate all of those things, that's very empowering. And so I'm with you on that. Just a couple of questions to round off, Linda. What do you think your younger self, maybe the younger self who was at that convent school where you were told that you were doubly damned, would think about where you are now? Would your 11 or whatever old self think about what you've achieved and the way that you've actually harnessed a lot of those experiences in your writing and teaching?
I wish I'd have known that, because when you're young, of course, you're always thinking, oh, what am I going to do? I can remember Cecily, see, I'd forgotten this. Cecily, strange, her memory for the present is not so good as mine, but she'll say, I remember you saying, I'm going to be a writer one day, and I can't remember ever telling her that. But she said, when you were 12, you said to me, I'm going to be a writer. And of course, Mrs. Hurst, my English teacher, wiped all that out of my head, because she told me I was crap at writing, basically. So, but I did lots of other different things. I did physiotherapy, I was a singer, I did masses of different things, and then did lecturing. And eventually, it is because of, you know, I was telling you before, one of my students was handwriting this essay and spied a little writing. And I got so angry at 11:30 at night. And I was thinking, why on earth can't he write properly? So I screwed it all up in a ball, threw it across the room. And in the morning, I had to resurrect it and thought, oh, God, I can't give it back to him like that. So I got the iron out, ironed out 18 pages, gave it back to him. And he said, what on earth's happened to this? And I had to tell him. I said, you've got to learn to type, because I can't read your writing. And I said, it's driving me mad.
I thought you were going to say that you turned it from an F minus into an A plus. I guess you probably did, with a bit of help from the iron.
Yes, but it's just that it is strange, isn't it, that I ended up doing what I actually wanted to do when I was 12.
Yeah.
But because all the stories that have been multiplying in my head just came out, and then, I'll tell you before we finish, the reason why I gave up my job, I met a student in an FE college I was teaching in. He was 24. And he'd read everything. He'd read every book. And I thought, why on earth is he doing A? He was doing A-levels at 24. And I said, John, I can't understand why he didn't. He said, well, I couldn't read before 17. I said, what do you mean you couldn't read? And he said, well, I didn't go to school. I mean, I just bunked off. And he said, well, I was pretty violent, so they excluded me. And this is this gentle giant of a man talking. And I said, oh, and I thought he was actually spinning a line, because I thought, no, he was such a lovely person. And he said, we were sitting in a lecture room, and he said, I want to show you something. And he took off his shirt, and I thought, oh, my God, you know. And I thought, this is really inappropriate. I'm his lecturer. And in his back, he had a deep hole, like a triangle. And I said, what on earth, Dad? He said, somebody put a chisel in my back. And I said, why on earth did you do that? Oh, he said, I'd knifed him. Oh. And he said, he told me things. He'd sew razor blades in a Crombie overcoat. He used to go out at night, sew razor blades. I said, why did you do that? In a fist fight, he said, they go for you. And I said, oh, John. And he said, you'd lacerate their fingers. And I said, I can't believe this. And he said, I was in a children's home from the age of six until I was, and then I was homeless. And I found my grandfather again. When I was 17, and I went there to kill him because my grandfather was the only person I thought I loved. His mother was a drug addict. He was taken away. He said my grandfather didn't try and find me. And his grandfather was such a calming influence. He said, I arrived in the door covered in blood because I'd been in a fight, and he said, come in, John, go and have a bath. And he said, all my anger just disappeared. His grandfather got out newspapers and taught him to read when he was 17. By 19, he'd read Homer. I've never read Homer. And I said, I have to write, can I write your story? And I tried to do it when I was lecturing, and I was so exhausted, and I gave up my job. And I wrote the screenplay. It nearly got off the ground 20 years ago. I'm still waiting. But his story is so inspirational. One person changed John's life. His grandfather showed him so much love. He said within 6 weeks, I'd gone from a thug. He said I was a really nasty person to a young man. And he went on to do an English degree.
Yeah. So you met him when he was doing his A-levels, and he went on, I'm so glad.
He went to university, and he got married, and he's got children.
Yeah.
And I thought, it just shows you, one person is all you need to believe in you. And John Adams is what, and I've still got the last essay he gave me. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
And I thought, he didn't know he had all this potential because he was not loved. So he said, if nobody loves you, why should you be good?
Yeah. Well, I hope it does turn into a screenplay.
So do I.
It sounds like it's been written, so it just needs to be greenlighted.
Well, it would help so many young people.
Just
finding that you've got... Find somebody that loves you, can give you some interest. And then, you see all these young boys that are in gangs, and you think they're just lost.
And it shows education is transformative. That's something that I don't recall ever being told that by my teachers when I was in school. Mm. And I guess that's probably why I'm in the profession I'm in now, because I'm trying to almost say, well, you know, I had wonderful teachers, by the way, but I'm very aware of what education can do, and to have that privilege of being able to promulgate, to disseminate, to teach, to, you know, to do the things that maybe some people were, you know, sort of slipped through the cracks, should we say.
Yeah.
But I got one more question for you, which is the one I always use at the end of my interviews, Linda. Are you a looking back or a looking forward type of person?
It's a strange one, that, because I look back because I love history, but I also try and think, because I'm always saying to my husband, David, you know, because we all do this. Oh, what if I'd done that to so-and-so, I wouldn't be doing it. And it's so negative to do that. And I say, OK, let's think, what are we going to do next year? And so I do go, I'm facing both ways, really. I look back in the past because it shapes you, doesn't it? It shapes a person. But I also try and think in the future, and I know in the future when I go to Eastbourne, I'm going to join things, I'm going to join the choir, I'm going to meet people, and I'm going to form friendships. And I think that's really important.
This has been a spectacular, a really, you know, I mean, we've been talking for over an hour, but we could have kept going. But
yes,
Linda, what a privilege. Thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Well, thank you, Chris, for asking me, and it's been a delight to meet you.